Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe. And on today's show, I'll be speaking with Lauren Gunderson about her new play, The Catastrophist, at Marin Theatre Company. Patricia Milton will join me to tell us about her audio play, Bystanders, and we'll hear an excerpt on Corona Radio Theatre. And our critic, Peter Robinson, explores fact and fiction on Netflix with The Dig and The Queen's Gambit, all here during the next hour on Open Air. My first guest is Lauren Gunderson. Thank you so much for joining me today.
What a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. This is a really incredible story. You're a married couple with Nathan Wolfe, and you've written a play called The Catastrophist. It's available through February 28th at the Marin Theatre Company. It's a one-person play, and the person being portrayed is Nathan Wolfe, who is your husband and a famous virologist. The New Yorker called him the world's most prominent virus hunter. And you started writing this during the pandemic, which Nathan Wolfe foresaw years ago and warned people about. Tell me about the process of interviewing your own husband and about the play.
Yeah, well, I mean, the conversation kind of came from Jason Mendakis, who's the artistic director of Marin Theatre Company, who's known me and Nathan for a long time. I'm the playwright in residence there. And at the beginning of the lockdown, Jason kind of very tentatively said, "So we're in a pandemic. You're married to a specialist in pandemics. Is there any play that you could imagine about Nathan?" And of course, at first I said, "Oh gosh, no. Art and marriage are different, are separate things." But the truth is, what occurred to me is that Nathan's story is not just his. It's also mine. It's also the story of a marriage. It's also the story of the scientific method at work, of the passion and drive. You have to be a scientist. And also the kind of metaphor of what the big pandemic we're in now is on a personal, intimate, micro level for one person. So it ended up, I realized I could write about a lot of things, which of course great plays are about a lot of things, but also do it in a way where it will be no surprise. We wanted to do this so that we could do it now in this time of great precaution. And so the meat of the play about a man whose work is devoted to viruses and pandemics meets with the story of a playwright writing a play, meets with the story of a marriage, meets with the story of great loss and great triumph, great learning and resilience. And we also had to do it for one actor to be shot safely and streamed widely. I'm incredibly proud of what we produced.
Tell us a little bit about him for people who don't know his work. He wrote a book in 2011 called The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic. And he sort of foresaw all this happening.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about him for those of us who don't know his work.
Yes. So Nathan is has always been interested in biology with the dalliances in math and other kind of fascinating subjects. But it all comes down to kind of figuring out how things work, why things work, and what we can do about them if we know those two things. And in his case, finding the science of pandemics means finding how viruses emerge, where they emerge. New viral strains always jump from animals into human populations. So going to those places and surveying the animals, the people who live there, the interaction that animals and people have to figure out which viruses are most likely to jump, how they spread. And his work now is at a company called Metabiota based in San Francisco, and really taking all of that scientific information, translating it into data, into models, so that we can figure out how to be resilient to pandemics, which the kind of cheeky way to say it is, if people had listened to Nathan and his colleagues and folks doing that sort of work, we might not be in as dire straits as we are now.
Yeah, it's extraordinary because People might have seen the book in 2011 as being sort of academic and like, yes, Ebola is a terrible thing, but it's distant. And it, what does it have to do with us, really? And so it's sort of extraordinary. I mean, you started writing this in the pandemic. Yeah. And it's a one-person show. As we said before, the person depicted is your husband, Nathan Wolfe. So, yeah, tell me more about how this came about through the suggestion of the director that you worked.
So, you know, a couple of weeks in, I think a lot of us in theater were thinking, is this the end of everything? What do we do? Can we do anything? What stories should we be telling? Should we be telling them at all? And our team at Marin very quickly said, if the question is the pandemic going to stop creative risk-taking storytelling? Our answer collectively is a big no. So we didn't know what that meant. We didn't know what we were going to need, what audiences were going to want to need. But we knew that we had a story. We knew that we wanted it to be a one-person play for the safety of the actors and director and crew. We knew we wanted it to be really artfully directed and filmed, but also still theater. So we wanted to see a stage, see the theater lights, see the theater seats. And in some way, it really has become a play about braiding the creation of a play and the creation of a scientific theory and science as it's happening. But all of that meant we had to keep track of a lot of things. We were never in the same room. I never was in the same room as our director or our actor. So everything as per usual was done on Zoom. But, you know, I look around and I see the fortitude and creativity of my artistic community, certainly in the Bay Area. And it's incredible. You know, give an artist a crisis and you're going to get 10 solutions. So we surrounded ourselves with a big idea, a big desire to do something fresh. So for me personally, that meant I don't want to just tell a one-person play that's, you know, a series of here's some stuff that happened in the past, or do any version of a play that I'd seen before. So once I knew that I could do some meta-theatrical magic and have some twists and make some surprises, even for myself while writing, then I knew this was worth doing, not just because we could do it in a pandemic, but because we really should. And we're going to end up with something really special and hopefully something that matters now in a timely way, but can also transition into hopefully a kind of timeless story of struggle and triumph and discovery.
We should mention that tickets are available at Marin Theater Company, and this is The Catastrophist is available for streaming through February 28th on the marintheater.org, and that's R-E at the end of the word theater. The actor that I think you chose for this production is William DeMeritt, who portrays Nathan, and he flew in from New York City. And I mean, first of all, tell me about your choice of that actor for this role.
Yeah. Well, I'd known Bill for a while, seen his exquisite work at places like Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He's been on TV most recently, and my friend Steve Yockey's amazing show, The Flight Attendant. So he has what we needed, which was great gravitas, great, excellent work with text. He has a history with Shakespeare, so he understands the kind of power of a single comma, but also has this wonderful flexibility and agility on screen. And that's actually what we needed. We needed a great theater actor plus a great screen actor, because this was both. So we found, I convinced Bill, I just texted him one night and said, hey, would you want to be in a new play of mine? And he said, yes. And I said, the caveat is that I'm playing my husband and my husband will, you know, be around. And he's like, I'm going to say yes. I don't know what this means, but yes. And so we found ourselves with a great kind of academic actor who knew how to dig into the text like literature, but also how to really feel and sell and had this kind of cerebral flourish. Because, you know, my husband is a scientist. He's a smart guy. He's has these, the way that scientists' mind leap and jump and make connections and go really fast. And so we needed an actor that could handle that. And so, yes, it was an amazing process. And Bill was an absolute trooper. Most of the rehearsal, again, was done on Zoom in quarantining after his flight, and the bravery and the boldness of being a part of a project like this, which we don't really have an example for anything like this. And so we were building the boat as we sail it, so to speak.
Yeah. You conducted interviews with your husband while you were cooking and over dinner and drinks. Did you use his words verbatim?
Yeah, oftentimes I did. I mean, I am a poor substitute for a journalist like yourself, but I basically recorded Nathan and I chatting. I think most of us have had a lot of time with our partners, with our families during these lockdowns. And so it's no surprise really that this play is so personal and so tightly focused on the people that it is, because it's what so many of us have had to do, which is to change our focus from citywide or statewide or global to your house. And so the play kind of plays off of that. Do we know the people that we wake up next to every day, our partners who are with us? Have we talked about every corner of their secrets and their truths and their passions? And so I encourage all couples to write plays about each other. You learn a lot. but it was, I will say, it's a shout out to my husband. It is, he's seen many plays of mine, and he is always a great note giver and a responder. He always has great notes to give on early drafts and opening nights and things. But this, of course, was a different thing he was signing up for. And I think if he didn't trust me and knew that I wasn't going to, go crazy with his life story, but really doing some hopefully exciting art as well as biography. But I will say it's also, it's character based on Nathan. It's not Nathan exactly, but there were certainly turns of phrases. He was also our de facto science consultant. So the first time I let him hear the whole thing was not until the very first day of rehearsal. So I didn't allow him to read anything because I wanted to give him that feel of an audience at the very first read when Bill read the whole thing through. And he, laughed and cried and blushed and all that. But then, as he is wont to do, said, okay, that was really great emotionally, but let's get some of the science right.
So you made some changes after that first rehearsal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always do. I'm one of those writers that is changing up until the very last moment I possibly can in that quest for kind of a more perfect play, ever more perfect. But certainly in the case of the science, there was, subtleties and nuances that we really wanted to get right in this.
Yeah. I have to ask, I had a friend just about a year ago at the beginning of this when it wasn't even very much in the United States, who said, there's going to be a pandemic and we have to get ready. And, it's here. And when did your husband really know, and how did he react?
I remember in January, him increasingly reading the news out of China with more and more worry and anxiety. And I think his kind of pandemic spidey sense was raised. And I remember pretty early on in February texting several of my friends based on his worry, saying, I know y'all travel a lot. Please buy some hand sanitizer and be really careful. Don't travel if you don't have to. So I remember, getting nervous enough because of his worry early on. And I think it's been unprecedented in many ways. But what Nathan has said before, which I assure he wouldn't mind me sharing, is, there's a lot of things that he expected in terms of how the virus moves, how it iterates. The big worry now, of course, is new variations of it. But what he didn't expect was the kind of social stuff, the misinformation and the resistance to obvious ways to prevent the virus from spreading, like masks and so that's the kind of social stuff that is harder social yeah. science as opposed to pandemic science that he was a little surprised by.
Yeah, no, I have to say, when my friend said those things, that there's going to be a pandemic, I just said, I mean, I didn't say it, but I thought, you're just a crazy paranoid person. I mean, that is just the craziest thing I've ever heard, that, thousands of people are going to get sick. That doesn't, and it's going to go on and on. Yeah.
Well, a slight clarification to make a point, Nathan, the title of Nathan's book, The Viral Storm, Dawn of a New Pandemic Age. So we are in the age of pandemics. And I think that is what we need to hold in mind, that when we get through this, which we will, that's not the end. Just because this is a once in a generation pandemic doesn't mean we can't have another one in 5 years and 10 years. So we have to be prepared. We have to find ways to bulk up our resilience and our resistance. And that's all of his work right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So Marin Theater Company .org. Is that right?
MarinTheater.org. You can also
MarinTheater.org is the, and it, this is streaming through February 28th.
Yes.
And it's Marin Theater RE. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, very exciting.
I'm really proud of it.
Yeah. Especially, no, what you're saying about making it a live theater event, but not like, I mean, taking into account the virtual element mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, we wanted to do a great, very simple, but cinematic film, plus a great, very simple one-person play, and finding the ways that both of those can augment each other instead of fight each other. And something that we're delighted that will be seen around the world. I mean, we've had interviews in Australia and Germany and Sweden yeah. and all sorts of places. So it really is gratifying and exciting. But it's also, it's a challenge to make something new in a scary time. And the question is kind of, why do art at all right now? Haven't we got enough to do? And of course, I'm sure you would agree, being an art fan as you are, an artist, that, you know, you always need art, especially in times of crisis. And
even more, yeah.
Even more. And the witnessing that goes on and the collectivity, the congregational element, even when we're all watching from our screens, is real and palpable. And that's kind of the superpower of the arts, is the empathy that, gosh, don't we need that ever more now, certainly when we start to come out of this. So.
Yeah. No, it was great to see you too in the New York Times. I love those photographs of you and yeah, wonderful.
It's been fun to do something together. It's an odd thing. I cannot stress how I never thought I would write about him ever. So it's been a surprise to me and certainly to him. It's a delight to his mother, of course, but the play is in many ways a way to talk about a love of theater and how theater is its own science experiment, which I think, as if you watch, that is what I hope you can maybe hold in your mind, is there is a bit of a theatrical experiment going on as well as a scientific one.
Mm, and wonderful to get to know your husband in the process.
Indeed. Indeed. He's a nice guy.
Someone like you think you know. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you so much, Lauren Gunderson. It's great to talk with you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for all you do.
Thank you. The Catastrophist by Lauren Gunderson is available for streaming through February 28th at marintheater.org, and that's theater with R-E at the end. You're listening to Open Air. I'm Sarah Keel, sitting in for David LaTulipe. Special thanks to Joanne Marr for her expert engineering of this program and to producer Neil Swinkles. Joining me now is playwright Patricia Milton. In a few moments, we're going to listen to an excerpt from your audio play Bystanders from Central Works, where you're in residence. And I love that on your website, you have a quote in big letters from Kingsley Amis: if you can't annoy somebody, there's little point in writing.
That's exactly right. It's very nice to be here, Sarah. And thank you for repeating my motto.
Of course. So who are you annoying in this play, Bystanders?
Well, I have to say, most of my plays thematically deal with some kind of social or political issue, although I try to make very sure that they are not screeds or lectures. I work through characters and characters that are being affected by the particular issue that I'm looking at. So I imagine I would be annoying the NRA with this play, although the NRA is not mentioned, I don't think. And the two women who are affected by a mass shooting are not gun experts. They have no political leaning around guns, but because of this thing that has happened to them, they have to somehow grapple with the aftermath.
Yeah, and this is available at Central Works, where you are in residence.
Yes, I actually had written the play as a stage play, and then the pandemic happened. Well, we couldn't do it as a stage play, so I adapted it for audio, which was an exciting experience. And we used the same actors. We used Kimberly Ridgway and Maria Marquis. It's a two-woman play. And Maria happens to be an audiobook narrator, so she has her own studio and everything. It was great. And we made it audio with Gary Graves directing.
Yeah. Bystander is kind of an incredible word in itself, because I think we all feel like we need to be doing more. And yet, you know, there's this feeling, well, we're only one person, so what can we do? But I want to talk to you more after we listen to an excerpt of your Bystanders. And this is part of this wonderful weekly segment started by David LaTulipe a while ago, Corona Radio Theater. So we are going to listen to anything else to say before we listen to Bystanders?
Well, thank you for doing this. I think the radio is a perfect way to introduce people to more audio theater, because that's the people who get it, you know, audio.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we will hear the cast that you have, the cast.
That's right. That's right. So it's Maria Marquis and Kimberly Ridgway, and it's the top of the play. So it's the opening of the play.
Right.
Central Works presents the audio play of Bystanders by Patricia Milton. Performed by Maria Marquis and Kimberly Ridgway.
It has happened again.
Reports are just coming in, but we don't have a lot of information.
There's nothing I would ever want another person to have to see. It was horrible.
I've always kind of felt like eventually it was going to happen here, too.
Good evening, Brett, and this just in
as
from Jake Gibson,
expected,
one of
vigils
our...
Vigils have been
called in the
It's a tragic scene.
It's a casserole for you. It's vegetarian. I made sure because I didn't
you
know.
You brought me a casserole?
I'm sorry?
That is the classic Midwestern worried friend cliche, showing up with a tuna casserole.
I'm from Florida, and it's vegetarian, like I said. I was so frightened for you.
Zane, I can cook. Or I'm safe to defrost, anyway.
I looked everywhere for you. This is...
It's a gesture.
Well, you need to eat, and you shouldn't have to cook today.
Huh. Will eating make me throw up?
It shouldn't. It has cheese.
I love cheese.
Good, then, because, well, it has cheese.
That's my comfort food. Is it mac and cheese? Too much to hope for. Lasagna?
It's got peppers in it. And tomato, I think. Rice.
Love rice. Oh, you didn't make it.
No.
Wait, Clarence?
It's delicious.
Made by Clarence.
He can cook, though. Hannah, I wouldn't subject you to
a second tragedy?
He's a good cook from his army training.
Okay, army training and good cook, though, they're not compatible.
He was a culinary specialist. Learned to bake, fry, braise, boil, simmer, steam, and saute all on your tax dollar. Mostly for large groups, platoons.
I'm never going to be able to eat all that.
I know army cuisine sounds kind of inedible.
You described army meals as mostly unspeakable loaf product.
Yeah, but Clarence's cornbread and his casseroles, too. He always puts in lots of cheese. I looked for you after we got back from the park. There was so much confusion, police barriers and reporters and random rubberneckers. So many people and nobody knew anything. I would have tried to get through, but I had to stay with the children.
It's okay.
And parents started to show up, and still no one could tell what the hell was going on.
It's okay.
I thought you might be angry at me.
Why?
I was worried for a minute you weren't going to open the door.
I'm not angry. I just thought you might be a TV news crew.
Have they been bothering you?
Fox 5 assholes. You must have seen the van when you...
I parked around back. And I couldn't ring. Your name isn't marked by the bell. Did you know that?
Yes.
Have you talked to them, or...
I told them to stay the hell away from me. They keep trying, every few hours, across the street. They think they're invisible, hiding behind that palm tree.
For 2 days?
Buzzards. We see you! You'd think that there'd be something fresh in the news cycle to snag their interest. Why do they care about me at this point?
It must feel very invasive. I'm glad you let me in. I've been worried.
Hmm. So you're checking on me?
It isn't formal.
You're informally checking on me.
You know I wouldn't come to your home like this to... I'm here as your friend.
I'm sorry. You're being kind, and I'm just...
You're hurting. It's understandable. What can I do?
Oh, there's nothing you can do for me.
I care about how you're doing, Hannah.
I am doing... as you see, up and dressed. Well, that's not true. This is what I wore to bed. Therefore, technically, I'm up, but I didn't...
So you've slept. That's good.
I lay on my bed. Sleep wasn't a part of it.
You probably should sleep.
No, because if I go to sleep, then when I wake up, it's a different day. It's a new day, and that is a day when they were never alive.
But it is a different day. Whether or not you fall asleep, and your body needs rest. You've been through an ordeal.
I have.
It's been... You have been through terror and chaos. When you get that close to death, I know what that's like. You've got to take care of yourself.
I am taking care of myself. The best way I know how.
Well, that's great. Good. And like I said, I want to be helpful.
You can help me.
Anything. Name it.
You can report that grief counselor.
Mr. Puckett?
Yeah, him.
You talked to him?
No. I sat across from him and stared at his sweaty face in silence.
You...
Why would I speak to that guy?
Hannah.
I let him talk instead.
What did he... Was he inappropriate? You'll have to be specific for me to report him. And I should do that right away. He's supposed to be counseling on site for another week.
At the school.
That's the plan. Tell me why I should report him.
He was Johnny on the spot, I'll give him that. Materialized, out of nowhere.
He's local, I gather. Apparently donating his time and expertise pro bono.
As a ghoul. You try sitting with that guy.
Harris says he gets assigned all over the country.
He can kiss my traumatized ass.
According to her, he worked with the survivors of 9/11.
Oh, sure he did. Because he's a ghoul.
What did he say to you?
Well, where do I start? He told me these gruesome stories about 9/11. Firefighters tripping over bodies in the stairwells. Secretaries jumping off of buildings, you know. The Twin Towers. Why would he share that with me?
He was probably...
I didn't give him the satisfaction of a response.
It sounds unnecessary. And wrong.
Telling me about people he thinks had it worse, saw worse, experienced worse. How does that help me? I saw what I saw. I lived through what I lived through.
I understand that.
Does he think I give a shit where else he's worked?
I'm so sorry.
And when Principal Harris fires him, she can tell him, from me, he needs a new wig. Okay, I'm in the nurse's office at McKeever, right? And Puckett swaggers in all beady-eyed and gung-ho. I take one look. He's got some kind of swatch of worn carpet stuck onto his scalp.
You know I can't report his appearance is beside the point. I'll tell her he blabs stories about 9/11. That's very strange.
I'm supposed to put my trust in Puckett to expose my... this weight of grief and fear that I'm holding to somebody who can't even pick out a decent toupee. To somebody who's going to tell a victim about the frightening, the unspeakable experiences of other victims. Aren't those conversations confidential?
Yes.
So, a year from now, he'll show up at some other catastrophe, I don't know, a cyclone or something, and he'll be all, Hannah crouched under her desk while the kids entrusted to her. Now, don't you feel better that didn't happen to you?
It's unacceptable.
Yes, it is. I would never talk to anyone like that. You wouldn't either.
Let me, I'll text her. I know she's probably busy, but I'll advise her that Puckett needs to be looked into.
He needs to be stopped.
Right, yes. But you and the others, you will need counseling.
Not from a man wearing a dead chipmunk on his head.
Harris says she'll try to fit me in later today. Do you want to tell her?
Hell no.
Well, thank you for confiding in me. You should begin to think about what you'll do, how you'll recover and come back to yourself. Therapy really is helpful. I intend to go.
You were at the park.
We all lived through
you the weren't there.
It could be a path to healing.
I am not considering healing right now.
I know, but what I'm trying to say is you might change your mind in time.
I can't think about it. My head isn't in a space to...
Well, I brought you a list in case for later. There's, I don't know, 3 or 4 counselors on there. Local, very good people with experience, strong references.
Fine.
I won't push. I know I'm pushing. Anyway, if you decide, it won't cost you anything. The district will pay.
Why... Zane, why would the district pay for a Brighthaven employee, an after-school contract worker?
Because they are concerned, as am I.
Huh. You know what Puckett told me? I forgot what I was... I was staring at him, mouth hanging open at some question he'd asked me. Oh, I know. He had just asked me... if I believe in God.
Oh, he's not supposed to do that.
Yeah, I don't think he's allowed by law to do that. Anyway, he tells me, just so patronizing, when people die, they're free. That's right. After people die, they're free. Do you believe that?
I believe they are relieved of burdens.
In church, that's one thing, but it's an asinine thing for a trauma counselor to say. Especially to somebody who didn't die. I wonder if they get to be free. Yeah, it would be nice. If they would never need to crouch in silence, shaking with fear in the dark and supply closet. Under a desk, listening to... That would be nice.
It would.
Is that what he told the 9/11 survivors? Death is freedom. When you saw that woman jump off the 62nd floor, she was being set free. Because I had a hard time not slapping him, I'll tell you. I just slapping him hard, so hard on his head, just slapping the wig right off his head. Pew! Right off his head. I did say something to him at the end.
Tell me.
I must have had a look on my face.
Contempt?
Horrified disbelief. He said, just out of nowhere, that he couldn't prescribe me anything. He couldn't get me any drugs because he wasn't a psychiatrist. So I said, then what the hell good are you?
And?
He had no answer.
Well, there you go.
I'll skip the counseling. Thanks.
I understand that. The absolute
I'd rather not leave the house.
Of course. I'm sure a counselor can come over.
You're pushing again. When is the school planning to make a statement?
They already did. Twice. The principal held a press conference away.
I mean a statement about me.
Harris talked about you at length. About your heroism.
She didn't say that.
She did. In her second press conference.
I didn't see that. Does she even know what happened?
The police briefed her.
I did nothing.
Of course you aren't responsible.
No, I'm saying I did nothing.
You saved those kids. If that seems like nothing to you, it's not.
I didn't save them.
You listen to me. You did what you could at the time and under those circumstances. You saved the lives of those three children. And Hannah, you need to hold on to that because that's the one good thing that can come from this.
I don't think so.
At a time like this, you have to cling to any good thing you can.
That's what you've got? Cling to the good?
You think you didn't do anything, but okay then, Hannah. I got a medal once.
What does that have to do?
Just listen. I was awarded a medal for saving someone's life.
But I didn't save them.
Our company got caught up in a firefight near Ramadi. Bullets are flying and the one reservist gets hit. And I have to drag him back behind our Humvee. A little guy, new, his very first op. His gear weighs 50 pounds, easy. He's hit in the shoulder, lying there beside the vehicle, screaming. And I'm thinking, suck it up and drive on, son. Meanwhile, the very same op, 10 other guys blown to bits. And what am I doing? Flat out on the sand, playing dead.
In the middle of...
a firefight, yeah. I'm thinking, this is a hell of a gig to go through to pay for college, you know?
And they gave you a medal.
For dragging a guy 5 yards, you bet. Did I take the medal? Did I wear it? Hell yes. He would have been dead. Instead, he got sewn up and put back into action before he knew it. And that saving of a human life, it's not nothing.
Sure. They're not gonna give me a medal.
You did great.
You know a lot about guns.
It was a war. I carried my M16 and my sidearm did not leave my person. I could strip and reassemble my weapons blindfolded. I know guns, yeah. I had to know them by feel to assess and clear any failure, even in complete darkness. Honestly, guns hold no fascination for me at all. I don't understand the gun obsession of some of these troubled young men. There was something else.
About guns, you mean?
Way before Ramadi. One day, I was playing at my cousin's house, and Richard, he was about my age. He showed me a bullet hole up in the paneled wall of his living room. His dad had been shot from a passing car. Richard called it a stray. I remember, like some hungry dog you find in the street. I was 9. I couldn't quite make the link between that hole hidden behind a framed photo and the fact that I would never see my uncle again. The link between that little hole and the immense gaping sadness it left inside my family. I never really understood it. Until Iraq. So believe me when I tell you, it doesn't matter. Tallahassee, Iraq here, it doesn't matter where it is. If you save a life, that's what matters.
I almost wish you'd been with me. You could have helped. But then the kids with you.
You didn't need me. I don't carry anymore anyway. And you did fine. Better than most civilians. I'm not kidding. That's what Harris said at the press conference.
Yeah, I must have missed it.
At any rate, if you ask me and you didn't, so I'm sorry. You shouldn't be watching the news at all. It'll just leave you feeling helpless.
I don't feel helpless.
I'm glad. You have plans? To take care of yourself, I mean. Have you spoken to your family?
I have a call in, my little sister. But she's, I don't know, crisis avoidant.
Oh, stay where you are. I'll check.
Don't say anything.
They saw me come in. And you yelled at them.
Just, if you're quiet. If you don't respond, they leave.
Oh, damn. It's all right. We'll wait them out.
Shit. Blocking them again.
Ah, clear. Well, they lack persistence. I'll give them that.
They've been here 2 days.
And here we are missing our big chance to be celebrities. Seriously. Maybe we should talk to them.
Screw them. The coverage is bullshit. Sensationalism, speculation, and gossip. Where is the coverage about what we might actually do? How this, maybe, could have been prevented?
A reporter from Fox came after me at the vigil. So disrespectful. Stuck a camera in my face.
Vultures.
I thought, you really want to know what I think? Fine.
I didn't see your interview.
I was angry. As soon as I said the word guns, he cut away. It's unbelievable.
It's not. It's the bystander effect. Everybody thinks it's up to someone else to do something, so nothing gets done. Everybody just stands by, acting helpless.
I agree. But it's more complex than
that. Yes, yes, it is. But some of it is simple.
Bearing arms is greater than children's right to live.
See? That's simple.
It's not, though. There's something in the culture...
No, okay, but what is simple is to look at it. We could agree that we have the problem at all, but we won't even do that. While when the news is busy making a case for hopelessness after every single incident, the social media blows up with thoughts and prayers and then fades into silence within a day. Until the next shooting. Then it happens all over again.
It's difficult. I'm not arguing, Hannah.
I notice no news people will say his name.
People insist on that now. Don't acknowledge the shooter, only speak of the victims. I think it's a good idea not to...
Maybe they should be looking at why he did it.
You have been listening to an excerpt of Bystanders by Patricia Milton, directed by Gary Graves, featuring Maria Marquis as Hannah and Kimberly Ridgway as Zane. Engineering, editing, and audio design by Gregory Sharpen. Produced by Gary Graves and Jan Zweifler for Central Works. To hear Bystanders in its entirety, visit the Central Works website, centralworks.org.
I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulippe, and I'm here with Patricia Milton, the playwright of that extraordinary and powerful audio play. You can hear the entire thing at centralworks.org. And Patricia, I think you get to the heart of something so important, which is how survivors are traumatized and how complicated it is even to be against gun violence and how to deal with the repercussions. That it must have,
I feel like being either in the theater or having these two women in your ears gives you a chance to kind of viscerally feel what they are going through in this aftermath. And that's how we can I think, begin to empathize and look at the problem from a very human level, which I think is really important for us to do.
Yeah. Did this come out of your own experience?
It did not, no. But it is my experience that I do feel like a bystander while an incredible crisis is going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And this play, as you say, was originally to be staged in a theater, and then you turned it into an audio play.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Centralworks.org. And yeah, congratulations on dealing with a very complicated issue and doing so beautifully.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you. That is music by Carlos Rafael Rivera. He's an amazing young composer. Carlos Rivera, who has written the music for The Queen's Gambit. And he worked with a number of Bay Area organizations, including Chanticleer, early on when he was still a teenager. Now it's time to introduce our in-house critic, Peter Robinson. It's always fascinating to hear what you have to say about books and arts and culture. And today you're telling us about two shows on Netflix. What have you been watching?
Yeah. Hi, Sarah. Good to be with you. And again, hello to everyone listening to Open Air. So I've been looking at two very different types of both movies and a series. And the first is called The Dig. That's D-I-G. And that is an expression used by archaeologists when they set out to unearth the soil and see what lies below. It's a truly fascinating movie. It's set in the year 1938. And the period, I think, is really important for the Europeans and for Great Britain, which is the home of the setting. It is just before World War II. And The Dig involves a small village in Suffolk. It's on the east coast of England. And what they are discovering below the mound, and a mound is a huge, like, hill, which signifies there's something below it, is an Anglo-Saxon ship. Now, why is 1938 so important? It's important because Suffolk is on the east coast of England. England is preparing for war. And throughout the movie, you hear the bombers flying overhead. So you've got that sense of doom. It's also important with the two main actors. Kerry Mulligan plays Edith Pretty. She is the landowner in the movie. And as a woman, she has strong opinions. She wants to see what's below it. Her number two is played by Ralph Fiennes. He is Mr. Brown. His name is Basil Brown. And Basil is the way you say Basil or Basil in England. So here we go, Basil Brown. And he is an expert, but he's only local. So they decide they're going to unearth this mound and find what is below. And I think it's an interesting story from the point of view of women, because in archaeology and anthropology, it wasn't until the early 20th century that women could actually get a degree in this particular study. They could get a diploma. And so here we have a multiple set of issues going on, not only about the ruins, what is below the earth, but also what is above the earth, the bombers flying overhead. And how does a village lady, which is the role that Kerry Mulligan play, in terms of being interested in this subject of archaeology? So I find this a fascinating story about how eventually the authorities get involved, the experts from Cambridge. And again, interesting that one of the key characters, Peggy Piggott, played by Lily James, is also a female anthropologist and archaeologist. It's a great story. You get involved in the period of time, the zeitgeist of what war means. You get involved in the characters in their relationships to each other, and you get involved in the soil. And the soil, which is what goes on beyond or below the earth, below the mound, is equally interesting. So if you're looking for a fascinating movie that will really fill your days during the pandemic, get involved in this story. The story is called The Dig. I highly recommend it. It brings all sorts of little elements together: village life, anthropology, archaeology, Anglo-Saxon boats or ships, as I should say, and the conflict between local experts, Basil Brown, played by Ralph Fiennes, and the know-alls, the Goffins, the Boffins from Cambridge. A great movie based on, in fact, a very, very true story with some characterization added to it. Now we're going to change to a totally different subject. The game is chess. And if anyone ever told me they could make a riveting story about watching people play chess, I would have fallen out of my seat. But in fact, The Queen's Gambit has ended up selling more chess sets. By Christmas of last year, people couldn't buy them. They'd all been sold out. So how did this come about? Well, again, it's a novel written by William Trevis, so in that sense, it's a piece of fiction. On the other hand, there are elements to this story that really resemble how things happened. And we're changing our time period here. We're back in the 1960s, and we're back at a period when the Cold War was beginning to emerge. And if you look at the game of chess, European town centres, you often go through them in the summertime, you'll see in the market square people playing chess. And above all, in Russia, it is one of the key games. So this is a story about a young girl brought up in an orphanage, fed tranquilizers to keep them calm. And as the story develops, she is tutored by the person in the basement. He is the caretaker. And from those early days, she develops a whole feeling for chess. I think it's important because women got some recognition, but not the type of recognition they deserved. It was indeed very much a male game. And I still go down occasionally to the Mechanics Institute here in San Francisco, which has its own chess format. Several telling things in this movie. Anna Taylor-Soy plays the lead, and again, female actresses, her relationship with her mother, played by Marielle Heller, is particularly important. In fact, it's a story of weird relationships in many ways. It's a story about addiction, but as I say, it's a story which really gets you involved in chess, and you'll enjoy it even if you don't know how to play the game. It's a story about music. Not only pop music, because you're sunk into the 1960s in terms of tunes they play, tunes you'll find yourself humming, but also the construction of the classical music, which almost is like in a play. It takes you from one movement to the next. And there is a superb scene when the mother is actually playing the piano and does an excellent job at rendering a piano piece. So here we have a story about a static game. It's a sports game. It's not a sport in the sense that tennis or football or hockey has movement. It's a story about moves on a chessboard. And even the title, The Queen's Gambit, actually refers to a move in chess, which, if you do it right, can almost decide the future of the game. One or two interesting scenes, which I think may be slightly strange. Towards the end, when the Bette Harmuth figure is staying in a hotel in Russia, she's on the phone getting guidance from her friends back home. And I think, having been and covered little bits of Moscow as a journalist, the one thing they tell you is never use the telephone. Everything is bugged. And so undoubtedly that scene stretches the imagination. Some people say the story is predictable. You know that she's going to win. That's not a spoiler. But I think the fact that I was drawn in at every different episode, I was drawn in by the costumes. Towards the end, she is dressed in white with a white hat. She's actually representing the queen on a chessboard. So costumes and the iconography are important. The music is important. The dialogue is important. And the sad story of addiction, how tranquilizers can lead to the next drug, to the next drink, the obsession and the obsession with chess. And then what I really liked is the use of intuition. Chess may be a mathematical game, but there's something about intuition that allows you to read your opponent, read the chessboard, and then look to the ceiling and find an answer that only comes out of your head. I think it's a thrilling series. It's a 7-part series. I think you'll get hooked. It's one of those binge watching. I watched 3 at a time and then finally saved the last one for my final treat. I knew she was going to win, but I wanted to find out how. So if you're looking for 2 great time fillers and you're at home and you're on the screen, here we go. The first is The Dig and the second, The Queen's Gambit. It's your move. Over to you. Turn the set on.
You gave away the ending.
I know, but it's predictable.
Yeah, no, it's so great and so beautifully done. And intuition, but also a sort of mapping. I mean, that she obviously has a talent for visual mapping of the chessboard and just beautifully done from one end to the other.
And I know you spoke to the music, to the composers,
yes,
didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, Carlos Rafael Rivera, very, you know, wonderful, wonderful composer. And his career has really taken off with the score for this, for The Queen's Gambit and the last episode, especially. I mean, the way he builds the tension when she's playing with the Russian genius chess player, it's just really extraordinary. So, yeah, thank you. Thank
you. Good to see you, Sarah. Welcome
Good to
back.
See you, Peter. Thank you so much.
Okay.
That's music from The Queen's Gambit by Carlos Rafael Rivera. We hope to get him on the radio sometime soon. It's the 88th birthday today of Yoko Ono. She wrote her conversation piece from 1962. So here's something we can all do together. Conversation piece by Yoko Ono. Bandage any part of your body. If people ask about it, make a story and tell. If people do not ask about it, draw their attention to it and tell. If people forget about it, remind them of it and keep telling. Do not talk about anything else. So that's Yoko Ono. Happy birthday to her. And next week on Open Air, host David LaTulippe welcomes the new Conservatory Theater Center to the virtual stage of our Corona Radio Theater, presenting an excerpt of Interlude in a world premiere commission from NCTC's New Voices, New Work. Also, an interview with Margot Hall, who directs Hieroglyph by Erica Dickerson Despenza at SF Playhouse, streaming March 13th through April 3rd. Plus, we talk with the wonderful composer and bassist Shinji Eshima about San Francisco Ballet's Digital Program 3, which starts March 4th. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe. Special thanks to Open Air producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Joanne Marr for making today's show possible.